Continuing Helen Wright's book, America, Cradle for the Second Coming of the Christ.
The stature of George Washington can perhaps be better grasped when one realizes that as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, it fell to him to turn farmers, traders, merchants, seamen, frontiersmen, and even young boys into soldiers. When the frustrating 8-year-long war ended on October 19, 1781, Washington made sure a peace treaty between all warring factions was signed by Congress. He wrote to the governors of the independent states of America, congratulating them on the glorious events which heaven has been pleased to produce in our favor. He then announced his retirement and called a final review of his troops to say a fond farewell. Jan Pierce records, quote, "The love and loyalty which flowed back and forth from general to soldier at the parade was an emotional time. In bidding adieu to his officers, he asked each one of them to come and shake his hand. They soon forgot their formal occasion and hugged and cried without shame." Unquote. Of Washington's character, Henry A. Brown wrote, "Modest in the midst of pride, wise in the midst of folly, calm in the midst of passion, cheerful in the midst of gloom, steadfast among the wavering, hopeful among the despondent, bold among the timid, prudent among the rash, generous among the selfish, true among the faithless, greatest among men, and best among the great." Thus was begun in America a cradle for Mary Baker Eddy's great revelation, discovery, and founding of Christian Science in the consciousness of humanity. There can be no question that the work of our founding fathers was done in response to and in fulfillment of a divine plan. That there was a divine pattern in which is woven the life and work of Mary Baker Eddy can be seen from such an example as the following. Quote, "In the colonial crisis times of 1776, the federal seal of our newly founded republic carried a picture of the Great Pyramid. Suspended directly above it was the rejected headstone portraying the all-seeing eye of God. Never has any nation in any of its federal insignia engraved profounder truths than those set forth in that seal." George R. Riffert, Great Pyramid, Proof of God. Here is to be seen a recognition by the founders of this great republic that the symbolic Bible in stone was awaiting the placement of the rejected headstone portraying the all-seeing eye of God. Mary Baker Eddy was guided in her life's work under the vigilance of the all-seeing eye of God. She was a scribe under orders who could not refrain from transcribing what God indicted. When Mary Baker Eddy published Science and Health, she figuratively lowered in place the capstone shown held in suspension on the federal seal. It was in this great republic that the Bible's sacred prophecy was to become reality. A few decades after winning of the Civil War, Mary Baker Eddy wrote, "Religious liberty and individual rights under the Constitution of our nation are rapidly advancing, avowing, and consolidating the genius of Christian Science." Because Mrs. Eddy had seen man, all humanity, as undivided from God, she saw our Constitution and its Bill of Rights as a giant leap forward in human history, saw our Constitution as a necessary step in showing God as the source of conscious human individuality. "God," she said, "sustains my individuality. Nay more, He is my individuality and my life. Because He lives, I live." Because God was the individuality of Columbus, of the Pilgrims, of those who framed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution with its Bill of Rights, and because these individuals were spiritually minded and listened for God's prompting, they became God's instruments and played their part in carrying out God's divine plan for universal salvation. The divine power operates unseen. We only see the effects of this divine power. When we plant the seed of an oak tree, we do not see the power that operates to break the seed open, take root, and grow into a tree. The same infinite, invisible power operates unseen in quietness and in confidence in our divine individual consciousness. It speaks to our receptive thought and causes us to act in a way that forwards the design of God. Chapter 7. The Civil War, the War Between the States. Abraham Lincoln's Addresses. After the Revolutionary War, America enjoyed over 70 years of success and prosperity. But as we grew, we as a nation became selfish. We forgot the God that had blessed us. Between the time Abraham Lincoln was elected and inaugurated, 7 states had seceded. In his inaugural address, President Lincoln urged all the states to settle their differences peacefully. Nevertheless, the country found itself divided by war. In the midst of this war, in 1863, Lincoln issued a proclamation to all Americans, appealing to them to recognize the true cause of the national calamity. Quote, "And inasmuch as we know that by His divine law, nations, like individuals, are subjected to punishment and chastisement in this world, may we not justly fear that the awful calamity of civil war, which now desolates the land, may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins, to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand that preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have become too proud to pray to the God that made us." Unquote. We know from biographies that Lincoln turned continually to God in prayer, not only before making an important decision. He also knew that the world's saviors have all, in one way or another, loved their enemies and done them good. Few public figures have attained Abraham Lincoln's magnanimous spirit, although he was vilified as no other American president. He was publicly denounced by Edwin Stanton as a low, cunning clown, the original gorilla. But Lincoln appointed him Secretary of War, because he saw Stanton was the best man for the post. When a friend told Lincoln that Stanton, then a cabinet member, called President Lincoln a fool, Lincoln replied, "Did he call me that? Well, I reckon it must be true then, for Stanton is usually right." Later, a repentant Stanton sobbed uncontrollably at Lincoln's bedside after the president's assassination. Lincoln's self-forgetfulness, his purity of thought and motive, his affection for his fellow man, his trust in good, were constant prayers. So well known to his countrymen was Lincoln's habit of prayer that several far-famed statues erected in his honor show him kneeling in supplication to an all-merciful God. General McClellan's vision. Lincoln's habitual fervent prayer availed. God's plan for America to become the cradle for the second coming of the Christ could not be thwarted. And as the hymn assures, "O blessed is he to whom is given the instinct that can tell that God is on the field, although he seems invisible." It was important that the Union be preserved. If the Union was destroyed, there would be no place on this earth where the Second Coming, the prophesied Comforter, could survive. Therefore, while God was graciously preparing Mary Baker Eddy for the reception of the final revelation of the absolute divine principle of scientific mental healing, infinite mind, God, was also preparing a place for the Second Coming of the Christ, the Comforter, science and health, since the divine must overcome the human at every point. It was crucial that this divine understanding be founded in human consciousness. The following report, showing divine intervention to preserve the Union, is taken from The Individual Christian Scientist. It was originally published in March 8, 1862, in the Portland, Maine Evening Courier. The Civil War began in April 1861. When Fort Sumter was fired on. When 1862 dawned, few realized how dire the situation was for the Republic. General George Brinton McClellan went to Washington, D.C. to take over command of the United States Army. At 2 a.m. on the third night after his arrival, he was working over his maps and studying the reports of the scouts when a feeling of intense weariness caused him to lean his head on his folded arms on the table, where he fell asleep. About 10 minutes later, the locked door was suddenly thrown open. Someone strode right up to him, and in a voice of power and authority said, "General McClellan, do you sleep at your post? Rouse you, or ere it can be prevented, the foe will be in Washington." In his published article, General McClellan described his strange feelings. He seemed suspended in infinite space, and the voice came from a hollow distance all about him. The furnishings and the walls of the room had vanished, leaving only the table covered with maps before him. But he found himself gazing upon a living map of America, including the entire area from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic Ocean. McClellan was aware of the being that stood beside him, but he could only identify it as a vapor having the vague outlines of a man. As he looked at the living map, the general was at first amazed and then elated as he saw the troop movements and a complete pattern of the enemy's lines and distribution of forces. This knowledge would enable him to terminate the war speedily. But this elation dissolved as he saw the enemy occupy positions he had intended occupying within the next few days. He realized his plans were known to the enemy. At this realization, the voice spoke again. "General McClellan, you have been betrayed. And had not God willed otherwise, ere the sun of tomorrow had set, the Confederate flag would have waved above the Capitol and your own grave. But note what you see. Your time is short." McClellan did note what he saw on the living map, transferring it to the paper map on his table. When this was done, he became aware that the figure near him had increased in light and glory until it shone as the noonday sun. He raised his eyes and looked into the face of George Washington. With sublime and gentle dignity, Washington said, "General McClellan, while yet in the flesh I beheld the birth of the American Republic. It was indeed a hard struggle, but God's blessing was upon the nation, and with his mighty hand brought her out triumphantly. A century has not passed since then, and now, by reason of this prosperity, she has been brought to her second great struggle. But her mission will not then be finished, for ere another century shall have gone by, the oppressors of the whole world, the Antichrist, shall join themselves together and raise up their hands against her. But if she still be found worthy of her high calling, the enemy shall surely be discomfited. Then shall the very small and feeble remnant prevail, and shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. Then, in the 20th century, will be ended her third and last great struggle for existence. Thenceforth shall the Republic go on, increasing in power and goodness, until her borders shall end only in the remotest corners of the earth, and the whole earth shall, beneath her sheltering wing, through the message of the second coming of the Christ, become a universal republic. Let her in her prosperity, however, remember the Lord her God. Let her trust be always in Him, and she shall never be confounded. Washington raised his hand over McClellan's head in blessing. A peal of thunder rumbled through space. The general awoke with a start. He was in his room, with his maps spread out on the table before him. But as he looked at them, to his astonishment, he saw the maps were covered with marks and figures he had made during the vision. This convinced him that his dream, or vision, was real and was from above. The kingdom of God within McClellan's own consciousness had revealed to him what he needed to know. He set about immediately to thwart the enemy's plan, riding his horse from camp to camp to implement the changes at once. The Confederate army was so near that President Lincoln could hear the rumble of their artillery. At the White House, which no doubt helped to keep him in constant state of fervent prayer for the safety of the Union, that prayer availed. McClellan's action saved the Capitol early in 1862 and saved the Republic from the second peril. The first peril had been the Revolutionary War. Chapter 8. Slavery's Abolition. On January 1st, 1863, Lincoln, by virtue of his powers as Commander-in-Chief of the Army, issued the Emancipation Proclamation. It was chiefly a declaration of aims and policy. Much effective legislation followed. Later, the 13th Amendment of the Constitution made slavery in the United States illegal. The abolition of slavery was a great stride forward in this country. It was the spirit of love prevailing. The abolition came about because enough people cared for their brother man to want him to be free. To stand idly by and not follow the dictates of love would be an omission of the duty which God has placed on the shoulders of all who live in His presence. In a day when it was still unusual for women to take an active interest in furthering social justice, Mary Baker Eddy's patriotic articles and poems in defense of the Union were published in the news media of that day. Other women also made wonderful contributions. Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin and Julia Ward Howe's The Battle Hymn of the Republic both had an enormous influence in crystallizing public opinion in opposition to slavery. Mrs. Eddy, in her 16th to 50th editions of Science and Health, headed her chapter Animal Magnetism with Julia Ward Howe's stirring lines, "He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet." Christian Science sounds the keynote of universal freedom. Once the Union, called America, was established on a firm foundation, as an accomplished fact, and slavery was abolished, the scene was set. The way was open for the establishing of Christian Science. The discernment of the eternal union of principle and its idea as all in all. This principle, which Jesus knew himself to be, expressed itself as the man Jesus, the highest human corporeal concept of the divine idea. It expresses itself as what is called man and the universe, and is currently leading to the recognition of the equality of the sexes, the annulment of the curse on man, and to humanity's liberation from all bondage. Of this liberation, Mrs. Eddy writes, "The voice of God in behalf of the African slave was still echoing in our land when the voice of the herald of this new crusade sounded the keynote of universal freedom. asking a fuller acknowledgement of the rights of man as a son of God, demanding that the fetters of sin, sickness, and death be stricken from the human mind, and that its freedom be won not through human warfare, but through Christ's divine science, unquote. The history of our country, like many other histories, illustrates the might of mind and shows human power to be proportionate to the embodiment of right motives. To legally abolish slavery in the United States was good, but its abolition in the human mind is a more difficult task. Unquote. To rouse the dormant understanding from material beliefs to the apprehension of spiritual ideas is this more difficult task. It is in the mind that the crucial battles between reality and appearance, between understanding and belief, must be fought. Mrs. Eddy makes it clear that all human experience is the externalization of conscious and unconscious thought. Blind belief causes mortals to cry out for help and then resist the enlightenment that would rid them of their illusions and bring the ever-present harmony of heaven into focus. We learn in science that Adam was a belief, not a believer. This indicates that Jesus, the last Adam, is understanding or science, and not just he who does or thinks anything. So the last Adam was not just a great thinker replacing a misguided believer. He was spiritual understanding, soul replacing belief, material sense. The resurrection is seeing the real man that was never in matter. The real man was never discordant or in want, to be made harmonious and fulfilled. But since the higher truth lifts her voice to inform man of his divinity, the louder will error scream. It therefore seems that the inspiration of truth cannot be gained without tasting the cup that Jesus and Mary Baker Eddy drank to the dregs. Because of this ignorance and resistance to truth, it is only through step by painful step that mankind is progressing toward the acceptance of its ever-present heritage of glorious, boundless freedom. What was the third and last struggle Mrs. Eddy saw? History tells us that during the Revolutionary War, General George Washington had a dramatic vision of two further struggles, namely the Civil War and a third great struggle in which he saw America burned to the ground, a struggle still to come. This third and last struggle Mrs. Eddy called the Great Battle of Armageddon, in which the Antichrist is working feverishly to discredit the Revelator to this age and her discovery of the Christ science, which reveals the nature of the kingdom of God with its infinite goodness and power within each individual consciousness. Elsewhere, Mrs. Eddy said, there is a great struggle before us, and it is for life. I dare not tell you what I know. Now you see what you have to do. Be a transparency for truth. This is the work, knowing what this science means. Get out of a sense of apathy. This battle is today upon us. What was the third struggle revealed to Washington in a vision? What was the struggle Mrs. Eddy saw? First, let's go back to Lincoln's addresses to the nation and his stern reproaches, in which he reminded the people that nations, like individuals, are subjected to punishment and chastisement in this world. Then he pointedly warned, may we not justly fear that the awful calamity of civil war may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for all our presumptuous sins to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. Lincoln then spoke of the nation's prosperity, but, he rebuked, we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand that preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. Mrs. Eddy was seeing this same tendency to forget God. Christian education was being taken out of the home, where it had raised up men and women who loved the Bible, where it had raised up people who were willing to count the cost of Christian liberty and fight for it. Mrs. Eddy saw and warned against the shift from the building of individual Christian character to the building of a group character conformable to society. As we shifted from a God-centered republic to a man-centered democracy, a historian writes, we begin to flounder. The third and last struggle is for the mind of man, to redeem it from under the curse of materialism. Between the centripetal and centrifugal mental forces of material and spiritual gravitations, we go into or we go out of materialism or sin, and choose our course and its results. In this battle of Armageddon, which is upon us, we need fervently to pray that we are alert to the power of words. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, said Solomon. With words, we have the power to edify or offend, to strengthen or weaken, to give hope or to frustrate, to purify or pollute, to build or destroy. Verna Hall, author of Teaching and Learning, America's Christian History, tells of her excitement in being connected with federal government work, where new opportunities were opened for government to do things for people and communities. She soon learned, to her dismay, that a government that can do things for the people also can and will do things to the people. Thus, she says, I experienced the beginnings of socialism. I saw the thoroughness of socialistic organization descend like a pall upon every facet of our economy and culture, altering almost everything. There can be no doubt that Mrs. Eddy saw that substituting the power of human law and human government for a recognition of God's government in the affairs of men was and is causing the third great struggle, the great battle of Armageddon, that she said was already upon us. In an article to the New York World, she warned, to my sense, the most imminent dangers confronting the coming century are the robbing of people of life and liberty under the warrant of the Scriptures, the claims of politics and of human power, industrial slavery, and insufficient freedom of honest competition, ritual, creed, and trusts in place of the golden rule, whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. A true patriot writes, nothing distinguishes the kingdoms of man from the kingdom of God more than their diametrically opposed views of the exercise of power. One seeks to control people, the other to serve people. One promotes self, the other prostrates self. One seeks prestige and position, the other lifts up the lowly and despised. It is crucial for Christians to understand this difference, for through this upside-down view of power, the kingdom of God can play a special role in the affairs of the world. As citizens of the kingdom today practice this view of power, they have an opportunity to offer light to a world often shrouded by the dark pretensions, illusions, of a devastating succession of power-mad tyrants. In 1776, the Declaration of Independence was the voice of the American people speaking through their representatives. Thomas Jefferson's words spoke for the majority. I swear, before the altar of God, eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. The qualities that can save a nation. Through the wholesome chastisements of love, writes Mary Baker Eddy, nations are helped onward towards justice, righteousness, and peace, which are the landmarks of prosperity. The following account is from the Christian Science Journal, May 1887. At a meeting of the National Christian Scientist Association held in April 13, 1887, a question was asked Mrs. Eddy, which related to the prayer of Abraham, that if 50 or even 10 righteous men could be found in Sodom, that city should be saved from destruction. Mrs. Eddy's answer is of profound import to all nations and peoples. Her reply, as reported in the journal, was that salvation was in proportion to moral weight. A life or a nation is saved in proportion to the predominance within of purity, patriotism, or other right motives. And this is the inner spiritual meaning of the story of Abraham's petition to God. If Sodom City had in it enough moral worth, it would be saved, not otherwise. Christian scientists should read often what Mrs. Eddy has said in Science and Health, how during this final conflict, the conflict between truth and error, those who discern Christian Science will hold crime in check. The birth and survival of this nation remains a wonder of the world. However, with Mrs. Eddy's passing, a mist went up when the church directors refused to obey the church manual and the explicit demands made in 10 of her 13 deeds of trust. These provisions terminated all central ecclesiastical control. Quote, "Taking the livery of heaven, wherewith to cover iniquity, is the most fearful sin that mortals can commit," unquote. Disobedience to the manual bylaws has obscured genuine Christian Science from humanity. We in the field who acquiesced in this disobedience are not without blame. Failure to honor and accept the second coming of the Christ has brought about a moral crisis in this country. So secret are the present methods of animal magnetism, the illusion of evil, that they ensnare the age into indolence and produce the very apathy on the subject which the criminal desires. Legalism has been substituted for spirituality. Today, the specter of an extended period of spiritual darkness looms as earth's stupid rest ominously continues, and Mary Baker Eddy's manual requirements are ignored. Mrs. Eddy called the advice to see no evil, hear no evil, heathen philosophy, which resists all attempts to uncover and kill lurking serpents. If we are too ignorant, too cowardly, or too wicked to uncover wrongs, and if we deny that these evils exist, that is, exist in hypnotic suggestion, we become the victims of this evil, and so thwart our spiritual progress. Quote, "He's a slave who dares not be in the right with two or three. He's a slave who dares not choose hatred, slander, and abuse rather than in silence shrink from the truth he needs must think." The Magna Carta, 1215. As we gratefully ponder the divine influence that was preparing America to receive the second coming of the Christ, and honor the memory of the sturdy individuals involved, let us for a moment look back to the year 1215, when King John was treating his subjects cruelly. Here again we see men whose hearts were filled with compassionate love for those who suffered intolerable injustice. These caring men rose in a body to formulate laws intended for all time to remedy the evil suffered at the whim of cruel or unscrupulous rulers. The Magna Carta, the Great Charter of England, was adopted by the nation's barons, who, in the spirit of love of justice for the people, undertook to free men of the inequities that were being imposed on them by their king. Of 63 provisions of the Magna Carta, 2 show distinctly the spirit of justice which the barons sought to have adopted. 1. No free man shall be imprisoned or proceeded against except by his peers or equals or the law of the land. 2. Justice shall not be sold, denied, or delayed. The Magna Carta, now nearly 8 centuries old, still stands as a protecting arm for England's people. It may be truly said, that which is born of love endures forever. Christian Science, too, has its Magna Carta, which Mrs. Eddy says means much. It stands for the inalienable, universal rights of men. Essentially democratic, its government is administered by the common consent of the governed, wherein and whereby man, governed by his Creator, is self-governed. Man is free because he has the kingdom of God within his consciousness, and what is called man is the manifestation of this divine consciousness. Man is but the reflection of the I am that I am. Therefore God, the I of you and the I of me, is not in its reflection any more than you are in the mirrored image that returns your likeness. On page 23 of the 16th edition of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy says that man is free because he should have no other mind than God. In reality, he has not. It is only delusion that he seems to have another mind, a dual mind made up of both good and evil tendencies. Again, in this same edition, she tells us man is free because mortal body and material man are delusions that spiritual understanding destroys. But man will not lose his identity because of this destruction, but will gain the conscious infinitude of being. Waking to real life, mortals find what they have learned from the senses to be reversed in the facts of existence. That which sense deems shadow is found to be substance, and what it deems substance becomes nothingness when the dreams of the senses vanish and reality appears. Recall Jesus' warning to Mary on that Easter morn 2,000 years ago, "Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended." Later he gave startling evidence to his followers when he walked through doors that had been barred. He was demonstrating that his recreated body was a more spiritual body, an advanced concept, yet still recognizable. This explains and gives credence to Mary Baker Eddy's assertion that spiritual man will always remain substantial and recognizable, that every spiritual idea will remain in a form or a body that can be cognized.